This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and Shane, and pay my respects to your elders, past and present. I'm Andrew Sayers. I'm the director of the National Museum, for those people who haven't met before. And I'd like to welcome you to the National Museum and the launch of this fabulous publication. I think everybody is amazed that this is an e-book. I think e-book used to be code for something that wasn't quite a book. But I can tell you, the mould has been broken. This really is a book. And I've had the most enjoyable time reading it. It's just quite fantastic. And it is a wonderful tribute, I think, to a lot of people and also to partnerships. The National Museum is, I think, deeply committed and has been for some time to the idea of developing meaningful partnerships. And, of course, it makes perfect sense that the National Museum here on this peninsula sticking out into the lake adjacent to ANU should have a natural partnership or a series of natural partnerships with our national university. And, in fact, in the museum's strategic priorities for the next few years, we want to develop the range of partnerships even further. A part of that is also to make use of the extraordinary intellectual resource we have here in the museum and in Canberra. And that's also one of the focuses of our strategic priorities. And I think this book is a great testament to that in action. One of the other things we're very committed to doing at the museum is to try to use and understand the collection of the museum to the fullest extent. And, you know, it's a marvellous collection that we have in the museum. And this particular publication and the symposium which it grew from was really an attempt to understand more about the context and the content of a significant part of the National Museum's collection. And many of the projects that we have in the next few years are collection-oriented. And I think that's a really very good thing. And the other dimension that I think is relevant to the discussion of this particular publication is that it has an international reach and will do a great deal, I think, to enhance both the museum's reputation and the ANU's reputation internationally. So the international dimension is, I think, extremely significant in this marvellous publication. I'd just like to thank a few people. I'd like to acknowledge Margot. And I'd also like to acknowledge the other institutions who have supported the project with the National Museum in various ways. I'd particularly like to acknowledge Howard Morphy. Howard, great supporter of the museum and colleague. IATSIS had a major role also in this symposium, and I'd like to thank Russ Taylor very much for that. I'd like to acknowledge the National Library's role in this partnership, Margie Byrne, Kevin Bradley and Shelley Grant, and also the National Film and Sound Archive, of which Anne Landrigan is the current acting CEO. It's the best sort of collaboration between national cultural institutions. A lot of people think we don't collaborate, but a lot of people don't realise that the national cultural institutions are talking all the time about collections, about ways of helping each other, about telling stories which are important to Australia. And I'd also like, finally, to thank the Embassy of the United States of America, who were hugely important in prosecuting this particular project. And there is, of course, such a significant a dimension of Australian and American collaboration, which not only led to the expedition in 1948, but also continues. So we're very thankful and very appreciative of the support shown by the United States Embassy. And I know that the current ambassador is one of the museum's greatest fans, so that's fabulous. Okay, that's all I have to say in welcoming you to the National Museum, and I'll hand back over to you, Margot.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And, of course, Andrew was once the new director, and now he's past the 12-month mark and made his mark, so to speak. So he's not so new, but he is truly a great advocate for all things Indigenous in the museum, from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, participation, various sorts of engagements and programs. So watch this space. I'd like to now invite... I'd like to invite Ngambri Elder Shane Mortimer, whose family connections to this area go back tens of thousands of years on his Aboriginal side. But on his other side, you may be interested to know, he's a descendant of James Ainslie, thus the suburb, who was a Scottish pastoralist and who was the first overseer of the property Duntroon, which are named after his, I guess, not so minor castle in Scotland, where he retreated to after some, I think, 20 years or so here. So I would like to allow Mr. Mortimer to introduce himself in the most appropriate way. Thank you, Shane.
Margot, let me first acknowledge you. Margot, in the last 30 years or more, in this country, has been a great friend to the Ngambri people and has been very inclusive of our people in this land that's named after my family. Canberra derives its name from the Ngambri people. Ngambri was anglicised to Cambry by Joshua John Moore, the first land grant recipient in the area, and then Lady Denman, the then wife of the governor, in 1913 proclaimed Canberra to be Canberra. So that's where the name Canberra came from, in case you wondered. And, Margot, just in acknowledgement of our friendship and the friendship of the Ngambri people, I'd like you just to accept this photograph. And thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure to make you very welcome to Ngambri country today. And following on Andrew Sayer's words, and Andrew, I take great comfort in your directorship of the museum here on the Ngambri Corroboree ground, and I think in your good care, it's in good partnership with the Ngambri people, just following on your theme of partnership. And to Martin and also to Margot, congratulations on all the hard work that you've done in bringing this book to fruition and your editorialship. I'd like to just very quickly now perform a simple ceremony, a simple dusting ceremony on behalf of my people. And this is an ochre ceremony that's very ancient. And I acknowledge in doing this my ancestors and the elders past and present of this land. And there's a very good reason for this. You simply toss the dirt or the ochre into the air, and it rises. And as it falls, so too do our differences. and we are united as one. So in my Wagalu language, I say to you, Yetamora Ngambri Dara. Welcome to Ngambri country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shane, for that inspiring and genuine welcome to country. I'd also like to say that at the National Museum of Australia, we actually plan to reinstitute a right of reply to a welcome, and which Shane describes as an edification process. It's a very big word, but I'm sure it means lots. And it encompasses both the past, present and future. So in terms of the past, as a long-standing member of this community, and I've known Shane Mortimer, you know, in various ways over those years, so we have a sort of a past and part of being sharing this space on this country. As a Ngambri elder, he's strong in culture, being on the land of his ancestors. But he's forging ahead as a future, and he's taking responsibility in a range of issues for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, including he's very heavy into land rights and native title in the ACT. So watch your backyards. But you're all far too enlightened to worry about that. It's all leasehold, don't forget. So I've already secured mine. Put my name on the native title, you know, appeal. Anyway, look, it's really great to see you all here, I have to say, and it's really a great response to our invitation, and I have to say a really good trick is always put places limited on the invitation. We had a full house like 2 weeks in advance. It is based on my own experience of not answering these things quickly enough. However, we have lost a few people on the way. You know, there's a dreaded lurgy hovering around. I'm sure there's some remnants of it in here. And as you know, there's something rather dreadful happening over at the Diamante, which, you know, whatever it is, it's pretty dreadful. So they've been fielding a few calls on people who've been held up by the police blocks on the way. So I want to take this opportunity to acknowledge some important elders and distinguished scholars. I'm not doing it alphabetically. I'm ordering it kind of by age, which is a little dangerous. I'm taking a few wild guesses here. Never mind, if your name's mentioned, you should be reasonably happy. So, you know, our elders here, you know, tonight, as far as I can see, is, of course, the Emeritus Professor John Mulvaney, who I'm always delighted to see coming to these. He's inextinguishable. And then there's Ian and Rosemary Dunlop, who may or may not have made it. I think the lurgy might have got them, but if they're here, in any event, I'd like you to hear me acknowledge them. Great warriors for Indigenous issues and history along the way. And Betty Mean, of course, who I know is here, who similarly has a long history with our mob in various ways. And Isabel McBride. Oh, it's probably got that out. I'm not sure what the order of that one is. And, of course, the younger of the set that I can see to mention here is Howard Morphy. It's all relative. So the scenes that you see behind me are from the International Symposium Barks, Burrs and Billabongs, which was organised by the museum in November 2009 and commemorated the 1948 expedition. Of course, you all know that because that's why you're all here. And in turn, of course, generated this book. And I hasten to add that it's not a conference proceedings. They're very well-developed chapters by 20 important scholars that reflect the synergies between the papers at the conference. They were worked on after, and they also reflect the degree of Indigenous participation at that symposium. And given that this whole symposium was about legacy, the legacy, much of which is directed towards the true legatees of all the research of this whole exercise. In the symposium, I really want to capture something of the collaborative spirit of the 1948 expedition 60 years on, which hopefully has carried over into the book. So in the launch, I similarly wanted to give you a little sense of the times, though this isn't, of course, this is a conference. And there were, for those who were here early and would have heard, and we will play it again later, the sounds, a bit of a soundscape going over here, over there, that was recorded in 1948 at the Red Lily Lagoon, which is near current-day Goonbalanya, and recorded by Ray Giles for Colin Simpson of Adam and Oka fame for documentaries 1948. Now, this is called actuality. I've called it a very new and pioneering thing to include actual sounds from real places. The footage you saw earlier is also original footage from the 1948 expedition across the three Arnhem Land bases and filmed by the National Geographic Society, who was, in fact, a partner collaboration in this symposium. And the multiple voices, which is the third and final point, is you will hear tonight, similarly designed in a way to echo in some small way the multiple voices that characterise the expedition, the symposium and the book. So, as you know, each of those aspects, as tonight, is across disciplines, across countries, across cultures and across institutions, some of which Andrew has already mentioned, and, of course, internationally, the Smithsonian and the National Geographic Society, who were part of the original one 60 years ago. Now, I'd just sort of also like to thank ANUE Press. I don't know whether Duncan Beard is here, because I think the Lurgy got him as well. And, of course, Nick Peterson and any other member of the board that may be here. It was a delight to work with you. NMA Press, of course, our very own. It's a co-publishing situation. And I want to thank my colleagues at the NMA and beyond for their support and assistance, particularly the Centre for Historical Research, and the leader of the gang is here, Peter Stanley, who did a very wise thing and let me have my head. he was not troubled by anything. It just happened, and I'm sure he'll support that. Lastly, but not least, is my deepest gratitude to my trusty assistants, particularly those who are on the ride from beginning to end in various ways, which is Rowena, who is somewhere, and you should put your hand up, Rowena, there, and Sonia over here, and also at different parts along the way came Catherine Agner and Rebecca Richards, who's also here. Our major sponsor was Faxia in terms of this, you know, and they're represented here tonight by Kerry Tim, who's there and who might even put her hand up. It's too embarrassing, don't bother, it's just something I do. And she heads up the Indigenous Leadership and Engagement Group, and who's very instrumental in making it the most important thing possible, which was to bring down the biggest mob of Arnhem Landers, like 25 or more or less, give or take, you know what it's like, to attend the symposium. And I have to tell you, it took no convincing at all. I reckon I didn't even get to open my information pack. I sent her home with it, but she'd already said yes. So, you know, which works very well with what facts you do in this area. Now I'm going to show you three two-minute video voices. These are special messages from three participants who clearly couldn't be here, and I think what they have to say is reasonably worthwhile, or very worthwhile, in fact. And the first one is Kim Beazley, and you can read what he has to say in the book in Chapter 2 called Nation Building or Cold War.
Well, already this symposium on the Arnhem Land expedition has had a substantial diplomatic effect. And this book, now containing the developed theses that were produced by many scientists and those engaged with the various disciplines associated with reporting on the expedition, will simply strengthen what has already been a very good diplomatic effect. From my time as ambassador in the United States, having participated in the original symposium. It was enormously pleasing to see the impact on the Smithsonian of the issue of whether or not Aboriginal remains should be returned, an issue which has had no progress, really, for a lengthy period of time, has suddenly been transformed, and it's transformed as a direct result of the symposium that we held. I think what this will do, this book, when it hits the United States and probably even further afield, will be to operate at several levels. At one level, it will be to enhance Australian and American scientific cooperation. It is such a good compendium of what was such an enormously significant expedition, situating it in its time, but also situating it in terms of its scientific impact. So that will be one layer. At another layer, it will have a very substantial impact on the way in which the rest of the world sees Indigenous Australia and Indigenous Australian issues. Already, our Indigenous community is powerfully influential globally. And every piece of reporting, if you like, on interactions between our Indigenous community and further afield enhances and builds and contributes to that very important facet of Australia's external diplomacy and appearances. So this is a truly significant book launching. This is a truly significant piece of work building on a very significant conference, which of course was a reiteration, a remembrance, a commemoration of what was an absolutely crucial scientific expedition in its day and an absolutely critical part of the origins of the Australian-American relationship.
You're clapping. Thank you, Kim. No script from us. I thought it was quite brilliant, just bopped in and said what he said. Another person who was given the opportunity to take a couple of minutes to send a message was Joy Williams Malwagwag from Croker Island. Now, Croker Island, as you know, you may know, was not one of the three camps, but it had a really intriguing involvement, and you'll have to read about it in Chapter 16. And it's all about the American clever man. And we actually have a fabulous little doco they made especially for the opening. Now, Joy decided that she would like to use this opportunity for this particular gathering in Canberra to not speak particularly about the symposium, but to say something that's really close to her heart. So this is Joy Williams Malwagwag.
Bukan orang habis nuki kembali main macam macam baru lah. Atau mana langkat bangak? Kaya macam mana langkat bapa? Anak langkat baru kaya macam ayam. Atau bangai dan belangkat bapa sekolah. Lala lala balan dia bakap man kalau ini ada mama lah. Orang habis yang mengat mana lagi? Kaya mengat yang habis yang mengat mung. Atau mana langkat bapa mengat ibu yo ini mana ngari mung? Ibu aja. Nengko. Wala. Ribi kau ni jadu, kau koro ni, kau nak pergi nak kara, jauh ada kaman, kaman kalau ini ada mama lah, kalau pergi ada orang pernah lakukan. Kalau kaya, baru lagi orang pernah boleh wah, baru lah. Kau ni jadu apa? Ada orang pernah nuwe, ada orang ada balad. Pakai ada orang ada ngantuk ah, kau malang ada pernah pergi wajah, oh malang ada pernah melayah. Baru lah, mana mengadu mereka? What you want? Padahal mengadu, mengadu pada orang bayu aja balada. Mengadu ni mempakai logo terlarang mengadu ini 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 Peringat juga penuh balan dia pen, panik di mana lagi? Baru kap mana di mana?
I'm sure you'll agree it's very moving. The third and last one we've got for you tonight, there were more, but we thought probably three might do you, Professor Ian McIntosh, who's at Indianapolis, Indiana University, rather, and his chapter is chapter 17 called Missing the Revolution, and it deals with Macassans. It does a fantastic and very revealing material. He's one of the few people that actually talk about this particular point, which you'll all read about on chapter 17. So here's Ian McIntosh.
Greetings from Indiana University in Indianapolis. I have 2 minutes to send my words of congratulations for a job well done to the whole National Museum of Australia team. Margot, Martin, Sonia, what an achievement. Your conference on the American-Australian expedition to Arnhem Land was a landmark event. What really stood out for me were two things. First was the strong Aboriginal participation in critiquing the expedition's legacy in all its aspects, and second, the manner in which you worked so closely with conference participants. This was a first in my experience. I know of no other conference so dedicated to the spirit of collaboration. Martin, for example, you sent me a number of documents relating to the expedition that I would not otherwise have had access to. These documents, as well as your review of my drafts, and also an anonymous review by one of my peers, greatly informed my analysis of what was undoubtedly one of the most significant legacies of the expedition. The adjustment movement in Arnhem Land inspired by my friend and confidant, the late David Burramurra, MBE. This was the sort of event that would have thrilled the Wurrumurra leader, given that the focus of his life's work was on promoting Indigenous cultures and rights as the foundation of a just and equitable Australian society. In his biography and related papers, I wrote in considerable detail about the Mountford era, and given my close relationship to Burramurra, I was invited to attend this conference. Unfortunately, I could not be there in person, but I was able to present my paper via video conference, which was an experience in itself. Margot, Martin, putting together this special volume is the icing on the cake, as they say. I look forward to seeing it. Congratulations once again, and keep me posted on your next project. I think it's time to have such an event on the legacy of the Macassans in North Australia, and we can bring in Islam and the legacy of Christian missions and so on. But whatever the topic, you can count me in. Thank you.
So you can see he's bringing yet another perspective to light, for which is not generally known. As you can see, we developed pretty good relationships. Now, it's my pleasure now to introduce you to Dr. Martin Thomas. And apart from being the co-editor and a fellow traveller over the past 4 years in various ways, currently he holds one of the prestigious ARC Futures Fellowships, which is based at the Australian Centre for Indigenous Histories at ANU in the History Program. He's working on a definitive volume, maybe it's volumes even, on the expedition, and no, he can't stop, he's at it. And you know the expression, you know, I was trying to think of what I could define him as, and you know that expression, and if I was, you know, done my research, I could tell you who said it, but, you know, a gentleman and a scholar. And I have to say, anyone who knows Martin will know that's him to a T. He's so easy to work with. I think he'll say the same about me. No trouble at all. No frisson at all. He's just such a gentleman. No. Yes, he's much more modest than me. I'm not a gentleman. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Look, it seems that we've got so many people talking about the book, I'm not going to really say anything about it at all. But thank you all for coming through the travails of sickness, fire and whatever. That's right, and cold that Canberra has thrown up for us tonight. I would like to, just firstly thank the contributors to the volume and to the conference that or the symposium that preceded it, but particularly to acknowledge the writers who are here tonight: Ursula Frederick, Robin McKenzie, Louise Hamby, Margot Daly, and one very other important voice in the volume is Professor Raymond Specht, who is not only the subject of several chapters and contributed his oral history, but is one of the two survivors of the 1948 Arnhem Land expedition. Thank you, Ray, for thank you for being one of the few people who could get through the volcanic cloud. It's he's got down from Brisbane, and it stopped others from getting out, but it didn't stop Ray from getting in. finally, I'd like to acknowledge some other guests here tonight, and they are family or descendants and representatives of people who were also directly involved in the expedition. So Benjamin Lang, who is the grandson of Gerald Blitner, I'd like to welcome you, Ben. Ian and Beth Marshall, who are representing Peter Bassett Smith, the cine photographer on the Arnhem Land expedition. He is the second survivor. He celebrated his 100th birthday in January, and but I think that in itself explains why he's not here tonight in person. He sent his delegates, though. Terry Hanish, who I've not met, but who is the, I gather, is Terry here? Ah, okay. The grandson of C.P. Mountford, the leader of the expedition. And Elaine Murphy, who's the daughter of Captain Walter Murphy, who was one of the camp commandants. And finally, I'd like to thank, I'd like to acknowledge Andrew Bray, who is the son of expedition cook John Bray. And so Andrew and his wife Georgia are here tonight. A warm welcome. And they were, yeah. Andrew was really sort of flushed out by the publicity relating to the symposium, and turned up, introduced himself, and said, "I've got something that might interest you, my father's journal." And so we do in fact have the cook's diary of the Arnhem Land expedition, and it's quite a read. It it does not disappoint, I can promise you. Finally, I would like to thank my co-editor, Margot, really for bringing this whole event to fruition. Again, you've acknowledged Catherine Aigner, Rowena Dickens-Morrison and Sonia Balaga, that who've all worked very hard on this project. So generally, beyond that, see the acknowledgements, because I couldn't begin to say thank you to everyone who's been involved. But certainly, Margot, when I sort of first met you and realised your position was a principal advisor to the director, it sounded like a kind of isolated thing. But in fact, what happened was the way Margot brought in the incredible talents and forces of the museum and of the wider Canberra community into this project, as we've heard. I'll say goodbye with one little update. I think the book is, I'm very proud of it. I think it's a pretty fabulous object in its own right, but it's also a stepping stone. It's about the legacy of the Arnhem Land Expedition. And this sort of keeps continuing well beyond the book. Only yesterday I heard from colleagues in Arnhem Land, and as you heard from Kim Beazley, as a result of the symposium, the Smithsonian agreed to release the rest of the human remains that had been taken in 1948 from its collection. And I had the great honour of travelling with three delegates from Arnhem Land who went and collected those remains last year, took them back, and so they're just preparing a reburial ceremony at Owen Pelly, or also known as Gunbalanya, at the moment. It's going to occur, I believe, on the 19th of July. Extraordinary kind of process is going on there, where Steve Webb, who was one of the speakers on our repatriation panel and is a physical anthropologist, has been called up there. And what Steve is doing is he's going through sorting out all these bones that have come back, and he's identifying them according to sex, male and female, and then he's actually further arranging them according to putting together those bones that belong to a single person. And then under the instructions of a very senior man there, Jacob Nyengel, each of those person's bones are being wrapped in paper bark. And incredible sort of symbol of the way things have moved on since the expedition. And initially these bones being taken in the course of physical anthropology. Now Steve, a physical anthropologist, is there helping, doing that essential work of identification so that they can now be returned to the ground, though, and they will be, in fact, buried in the earth, but wrapped in paper bark, each one as an individual person, and that sense of individuality restored. So it's a kind of story that who knows where it's going to end, but I'd really like to thank the National Museum for being involved in this. Thank you.
So you can see the legacy lives on. Thank you very much, Martin, for that insight. And I have to say, even now, every other week, something happens. It just reminded me when I didn't show you Josh Harris's, an ex-National Geographic Society man, was reminded us that there's miles of footage that was found that no one knew existed on this whole expedition. There's just stuff turning up everywhere. Some of the Mountford, you know, the beautiful bark paintings. Some, of course, as you know, were done on paper, but they were in the South Australia Museum or Library. South Australia Library, of course, recorded under manuscripts being on paper, and so no one even knew there's all these extra fabulous images. So, I mean, it just goes... So it sort of activated a whole range of researchers across a whole range of disciplines and lots of different countries and archives who are now stimulated to do something with it. Now, on the vagaries of weather... as you know, you can see from the invitation, the Pro Vice Chancellor Mandy Thomas is billed to launch this book. But what you don't know is somewhere in between, her boss, the VC, decided to dispatch her to the land of the long white cloud. But before she could do that, we found Anne McGrath filled the breach, as she would, sister girls there, and. Then, a little while further, this whimsical ash cloud hovered between here, Australia and New Zealand. And Professor Mandy Thomas couldn't go. So you are really lucky you have two launches tonight. One real, the last one is probably the real one, and a supporting act. So you have the supporting act. So this is, you know, one for the books, and they will not disappoint you. So now I think I might two for the price of one, actually. So now I might invite Professor Anne McGrath to say a few words, and She has a very long association with the museum, as long as we've lived, that is, in this capacity. And she has various capacities, and some may not know, she was actually a senior curator at the National Museum in the opening years and part of the original blockbusters that were here. And then she became the inaugural head of the Australian Centre for Indigenous Histories, which she now heads up and has done amazing things. But probably the most, and I say this because it's relevant to everything we've spoken about tonight, what Andrew's spoken about, what Martin's spoken about, is the most telling of her many innovative achievements can be summed up in the honorary doctorate that she has just come back from Sweden. She received it from the Linnaeus, I think I got the right, University in Sweden for her amazing contribution to historical research in the fields of Indigenous projects and post-colonialism in new media. So what she's done and why the museum could hook in various ways is that she is following up the way black fellas tell history, to put it without using the discourse words. So looking at other ways of telling history through art, through, you know, IT, through films, through a whole range of things. So I won't steal her thunder anymore. She'll probably say something about that. But she does, I have to say, she brazenly goes into areas that others fear to tread, and often receives a few bruises on the way. But, you know, her integrity and courage to go to pioneer in locking into the way we tell our histories is really appreciated. Thank you, Anne.
Well, people often say it's a hard act to follow, but I'm not sure which act is the hardest to follow. I mean, it's just been amazing, all the what we've heard so far. And, of course, this book and this whole project is a hard act to follow as well. I'd like to honour the traditional custodians and thank you for your wonderful welcome tonight. And I'm very pleased to speak on this occasion, and I will be brief, but I'm very proud of this wonderful book's strong association with the Australian Centre for Indigenous History at ANU. It's a great example of scholarship and also of the rich treasures that can be offered when the National Museum Press gets together with the ANU ePress. Martin Thomas is an ARC Future Fellow with our centre, as Margot's already told you. And Martin is a very productive, imaginative and eloquent scholar, as you'll find the eloquent when you read the beautiful writing in the book. Of great assistance to PhD students, he is also a great model of scholarship. His research is innovative. It goes in fresh historical directions that include, for example, radio broadcasting, the kind of thing most historians generally ignore. And here he brings his own technical expertise and insight from actually being a practitioner in the field. Margot Neal, well, nobody probably knows who she is, but she's sitting over there. She is actually an adjunct professor at the Australian Centre for Indigenous History, and she's always facilitated and encouraged a strong collaboration of research between ANU and the National Museum of Australia. We had one large Australian Research Council grant, which was called Unsettling Histories, Indigenous Modes of Historical Practice. And wonderfully, this was actually created an association with the fantastic Emily Kungware exhibition. And consequently, I was fortunate enough to go to the openings in both Osaka and Tokyo. And they were hugely successful. And I got a photo of Margot with the princess and all that kind of thing. But it really was, it was a huge hit. And the thing is, a lot of people don't think of art as being associated with history. But, you know, we've had a lot of great discussions about how Indigenous art is a very strong way of telling country, telling life story, telling history. Then there was another Australian Research Council linkage grant with the National Museum and our centre called Indigenous Collectors and Collecting, with, once again, Margot as a partner investigator. It resulted in excellent training for a PhD student. She wrote a fantastic thesis, but also she was trained in-house by the museum in collections, in research, in running conferences, in so many fantastic things. She did so well, in fact, that she got rave reports and was recommended for a prize by her examiners. And not only that, she put her hat in the ring for a very prestigious postdoctoral scholarship at Gothenburg University in Sweden in a big new research workshop in heritage studies. And out of all the people in the world who applied, she was one of the three that was successful. And so we really feel that this is the kind of opportunity that only flowed because of this fantastic collaboration and her wonderful training, unique training experience internationally that was clearly recognised by this very competitive European-funded process. So all of these projects are the kind of projects that don't end when the money stops. They continue, they lead to other projects. Now, reading the book on the Arnhem Land expedition, it's fascinating the way the authors each present a different window into the world of the history of this expedition and its Indigenous participants. Without going into any detail, because that will come soon, I love the way, for example, Martin Thomas made such lovely observations about what it was like to be there that you almost feel you could walk around in the time of the expedition. And I think that the very posed-looking cover tableau, in fact, gives you a great sense of what's inside the book, because you really do get a sense of the grit and even the fights and biffo that's sort of going on between the different participants, the tensions, but it all ends up, you know, being a pretty positive, happy ending, I guess. Philip Jones's chapter promises to get inside Mountford's tent, and in many ways he does do that, reminding people of the difficulties of leading anything, but perhaps also giving us courage that it might all be worth it. And then, of course, we've seen ANU's previous chancellor, now Australia's ambassador to the US, and Kim Beazley, who really recognised the importance of this and also wrote an excellent article. So the cross-cultural insights into the ripples caused by the expedition come out clearly in the book. The conflicts that the expedition created within the Indigenous societies, within the expedition itself, and between both are beautifully drawn. There's no censorship or trying to smooth over the rifts here. The role of people like Jerry Blitner come out so clearly and powerfully. Margot's witty conclusion touches on the experience of the symposium itself and issues of repatriation. But the whole project reveals a respectful revisiting of history and provides a respectful examination through visual, oral, three-dimensional, plus the multidimensionalism of the participants and their descendants who also participate in the symposium. The book shows his acknowledgement of the elders, both the scientific elders and the Indigenous knowledge custodians. Where participants are no longer living, the efforts that were made to bring the sons and the daughters and the descendants here to share their knowledge and to create a real, tangible, peopled connection, I think is very impressive and something the National Museum has a track record of doing really, really well. For example, there was a Blitner at the symposium, there was a Harney, and there were many of the leading scientific elders were there, and Australian and American, and they all received the honours due to them and the respectful and fascinated audience hearing. And they were certainly, I hope, felt honoured by the wonderful symposium. The symposium demonstrates yet again the power of the space of the National Museum of Australia to bring the nation together and to honour its history, but also to bring that history to the attention of the wider world, especially in this case the US. Now, the book makes the achievement of the symposium so much more permanent and so much more Googleable now as it's an e-publication. Now, Mandy Thomas is going to say a lot more than me about the book itself, engaging with the book itself, but I would like, without giving anything away, and there's nothing worse than people telling you about the ending of a book, but finally I'll say, without giving it away, the book does end with a nice quote from Mountford that both Margot and Martin might well take on as their motto. And while I won't tell you what it is, it involves a dog, ideas and fleas. and I therefore look forward to the editor's next big ideas and our next fruitful collaboration. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Anne. Now, of course, we're going to get to the main course, and that's Mandy, who is the Pro Vice Chancellor, Professor Mandy Thomas, a woman of grace, gentleness and humility is what I decided to think up for you. Very tough on the inside and obviously a woman in a male-dominant domain, such as universities in general, I won't say ANU in particular. Actually, there's too many of you here. It is really quite a remarkable achievement and there's no doubt she will have some amazing insights on the book, which is read cover to cover online. Thank you, Mandy.
Thank you very much. So it's now more than 60 years since the American-Australian Scientific Expedition launched their exploration into Arnhem Land. It was in 1948 that 15 men and two women set out on their seven-month excursion, Adventure or Odyssey, into Arnhem Land with 47 tons of equipment and provisions. This superb book has revealed that the excursion remains one of the most important and most ambitious expeditions and experiments ever mounted in Australia. The large global audience that were exposed to the Arnhem Land expedition through National Geographic increased the profile of Indigenous Australians and of Australia to the world. This volume explores why it was so important at the time. It was front page news and involved both politics and science, and why it continues to be of critical value today. So firstly, what were the expedition's aims? Well, from this volume, it's clear that most of the people who went on the expedition were not fully aware of the wider political ramifications of their trip. The first aim of the trip, as outlined in a private letter between Mountford and the head of the National Geographic Society, was to establish a good neighbour policy and scientific cooperation between the United States of America and Australia. Another aim was to determine the food resources of land and sea as data for future military operations. Clearly, international politics and propaganda played an important role in the expedition. The book explains that this is not certain, that it's not certain how much the members of the expedition were aware of this, however. For what they had clearly in their mind was an investigation into the Indigenous people and the environment of Arnhem Land from numerous disciplinary perspectives. In addition to an ethnographer, archaeologist, photographer and filmmaker, the expedition included a botanist, a mammalogist, an ichthyologist, person who studies fish, an ornithologist, and a team of medical and nutritional scientists. They visited three base camps, Groot Island, Yirrkala, and Owen Pelly, now Gunbalanya. It seems that the original organisers of the expedition believed that Arnhem Land's cultures were fast disappearing and that somehow they needed to be captured in their pristine environment. This was clearly absurd, and the surprise with which expedition members found out that Aboriginal people in Arnhem Land clearly had a much greater insight into the issues at stake and the reasons for the expedition is now quite apparent. While it now appears that the expedition was the end of empire, a sort of historical reenactment as described by Annie Clark and Ursula Frederick in their article in the book, it was partly so because of the very long time it took to get the chronicles of the expedition published. The fourth and final volume was not out in published form until 1964. Why was the 1948 Arnhem Land expedition so important, so critical to the thinking of the period, and signalling such a point of change in the thinking of the times? Well, firstly, as Martin Thomas points out, the concept of an expedition already seemed archaic. The sorts of ethical concerns that confront us today seem profoundly at odds with the meaning behind the 1948 expedition. As Thomas points out, quote, "The expedition is a uniquely Western mode of moving through space and acquiring knowledge. Indeed, given its centrality to empire building in the exploratory phases, the notion of the expedition is central to the very construction of the idea of the West and the claimed advancement of Western over other societies. An expedition is by definition much more than a journey. To qualify as such, an expeditionary party must leave more than footprints. Typically, it will dislocate living and non-living objects from the environment it traverses, transforming them into specimens. Invariably, it will produce maps, pictures, or written documents, unquote. That is, the notion of an expedition was already anachronistic when the Arnhem Land expedition set forth. But by the time the published works were out, it seemed all but a distant memory. The logistical challenges of putting together the symposium and this book were immense. This is because the journey involved was by nature transnational and involved the collaboration of many different sponsors and partners in two countries, among them the National Geographic Society, the Smithsonian Institution, and various agencies of the Commonwealth of Australia. Out of the expedition came volumes of scientific publications, kilometres of film, thousands of photographs, tens of thousands of scientific specimens, and a vast array of artefacts and paintings from across Arnhem Land. At the same time, the politics of the period meant that Australia's national security concerns were at stake. An understanding of Australia's north was of great relevance to defence, along with managing the alliance between the US and Australia, as outlined by Kim Beazley in his chapter. There was indeed path-breaking research that was undertaken as part of the expedition. One such research area was exemplified in John Altman's chapter on the utilisation of wildlife and food gathering techniques in Arnhem Land. He showed that the 1948 expedition research undertaken by Margaret MacArthur and her colleagues was indeed remarkable and provided a baseline which remains very useful today. The research indicated that in 1948 Aboriginal people could meet their dietary needs consuming only naturally occurring foods with reasonably modest labour input. Altman also reveals how remarkably resilient the customary sector has remained over the 60-year period. I'd like to acknowledge Betty Meehan in the audience tonight. Betty also did some extremely important work mentioned in the book on the utilisation of wild food in Arnhem Land. Another great innovation of the expedition were the recordings of the rock art. Frederick McCarthy and Franz Selsler recorded rock art described by Clark and Frederick in this volume as the most detailed recording of Groote Eylandt rock art published to date, marking a definitive period in the development of rock art research in Australia. Likewise, the archaeology of the expedition and the presence of an archaeological team when Australian archaeology was in its infancy was extremely significant. The scale of the project was enormous and has never been repeated, mostly because of the change in archaeological methods and professional standards. It was thus both a relic of an earlier era of archaeology and pioneering in its establishment of archaeology as a legitimate discipline, representing a major sea change in the field. It was only in 1962, a few years later, that John Mulvaney announced the findings of a Pleistocene dates in Kenneth Cave in Queensland. In addition to more traditional ethnographic material that was collected, string figures were also collected by Frederick McCarthy, as outlined in the wonderful chapter by Robin McKenzie. Likewise, Louise Hamby presents a chapter on the collection of fibre objects, mostly baskets, by the ethnographers, as part of a larger material culture collection. And she reveals that there were more fibre objects than bark paintings that were collected. Other fascinating aspects of the story are the remarkable preservation, a discovery and preservation of the films of the expedition, which hopefully soon we'll all have access to. Raymond Specht, here tonight, the plant ecologist from South Australia, also provided an extraordinary botanical collection from the expedition, including ecological surveys and vegetation maps. This comprehensive work is of vital use today and has created a botanical collection of national and international significance, as argued by Lynn McCarthy in her chapter in the volume. Thank you very much, Raymond. Many of the fascinating aspects and contradictions of the expedition are drawn on in the book, to begin with the anomalous, although central, figure of Charles Mountford. Charles Mountford was clearly a difficult person who almost lost the leadership of the group while the expedition was being enacted. His obsession with collecting Aboriginal art was, he said, because he wanted to save it from extinction. He has often been described as arrogant and ill-informed. Nevertheless, his volume on bark paintings remains one of the most detailed and accurate records of Aboriginal material culture ever produced. He was a man of many contradictions, at one moment being a very careful ethnographer and at other moments being immune to the wider ethnographic material that was presented to him. An example of this is when he was organising the expedition to document a ritual and at the same time insisting that people involved get out of their trousers and into more traditional gear. As Denise Chapman and Susie Russell show in their chapter on Mountford, while detractors may have questioned his scientific credibility, scholars have subsequently acknowledged that much of the work contributed to the popularisation of Aboriginal art both in Australia and overseas. Philip Jones argues that Mountford achieved more success than any other individual in promoting Aboriginal art, and his collection formed the basis of Aboriginal collections in Australian art museums. Fantastic for Mountford. Another chapter of note is Bruce Birch's chapter on the way in which American David Johnson, a mammologist, was viewed by Aboriginal people at the time of the expedition as the American clever man. Birch reveals that this story provides a rare insight into how Indigenous people of Arnhem Land tried to make sense of the alien culture that was thrust upon them, the result of the interaction of two distinct culturally reinforced worldviews. One of the controversial aspects of the expedition was a collection of human remains that you've heard of from the burial sites by Franz Seltzler. The issue was finally resolved with the repatriation of the remains from the Smithsonian, and this was only very recent and caused great concern, anger and sadness in Arnhem Land. Indeed, this book shows how much the world has changed in just 40 years. It gives examples of how the return and re-evaluation of the artefacts of the expedition have led to a reinterpretation of events and how the past has now attained a different value. One example of this is Maritan Barwick's account of the way that dancer David Rankin has recently subtly alluded to the past in his choice of movements in the dances he performs. This was no mere emulation of the past, but rather a moment in which new meanings were generated. Indeed, the recordings that were made at the time of the expedition are now widely disseminated within the community, and there is a store of material that has huge value to contemporary society. One of the most fascinating chapters is Martin Thomas's piece on Gerald Blitner, one of the people hired by the expedition party, whose mother was Aboriginal and whose father was white. Martin was able to interview Gerald before he died in 2008. By hunting through all the wealth of material on the Arnhem Land expedition, Thomas was able to see the way that Gerald was overlooked or ignored by the expedition's chroniclers of the period. He's able to show how race was one of the defining fault lines of history of the research venture. This chapter is a stunning historiographical tour de force. Thomas analyses the huge mixture of media available, the 2,000 pages of written reports, the film, audio and photographic records, the collections of flora and fauna, and all the telegrams and financial paperwork available in an examination of Blitner's testimonial in conversations with these collections. Thomas reveals a stunning lack of interest in mixed-race people by the expedition. Even as a photographic subject, Blitner was kept outside the frame, except for one photograph where it's totally obscured because of the lighting, perhaps even deliberately. Finally, in the last chapter is a very moving account of the community participation and the private anniversaries, which is such an important element of the symposium. Margot O'Neill suggests in this epilogue that an online research portal would now provide an obvious way forward to bring forth new mechanisms to keep the expedition alive and address the dispersal of the collections and photographs to the people who are intimately involved but who are not represented directly in the book. In spite of the enormous interest on the part of the media and the scientific attention it drew, the American-Australian scientific expedition into Arnhem Land has only recently been re-evaluated for its significance by the authors of this book. The symposium that was held here at the National Museum of Australia in 2009 helped to bring into centrality the Indigenous perspectives that were marginalised 60 years ago. Margot O'Neill recounts a very moving reunion of Indigenous and non-Indigenous descendants and two surviving expeditioners that were held prior to the symposium. Here, many stories were recounted of the expedition and histories were shared. In spite of what was often called journalistic treasure hunting, as described by Murray Gard in his chapter on recording ceremony, there's now the possibility of the return of this important cultural information to the communities which are reacquainting themselves with this material. This book has reanimated and reevaluated the expedition and is an enduring record of time past and of how the past becomes integrated into the present. By examining the nature of the impact of the Arnhem Land expedition, we can see that the conflicted views about Aboriginal futures that exist today was already there in 1948. But this work has only just begun. As Thomas points out in his introduction, the book itself creates tensions. The amount of scholarship available on the expedition is not yet aligned with the unprecedented scale and the importance of the expedition itself. Clearly, our full understanding of the significance of the expedition is just beginning to emerge. This splendid book has taken us on the first steps of a fascinating and important journey for contemporary Australia. Congratulations to Martin and Margot and to all the authors of this truly marvellous book. Thank you.
Well, you can unbuckle your seatbelts now. Thank you very much, Mandy. That was truly a paper we actually should pop into the book, really. so insightful. So you put so much thought and energy into it. We really do appreciate that. Thank you. I know it's been quite a long journey, but I don't think it's been uneventful or unpleasant. However, you're released from your seats now. And once again, thank you, everyone, very much for coming. It's really, really appreciated. There's so many amazing people in this room. It's all about quality, not quantity. No, that's right, got it right. So I'm really, really thrilled. And you know, there are some marvellous, you've heard so many people referenced here in relation to their book and their research and their past and their lineage. And by the way, that Terry Hainish, he actually lives in Queanbeyan. This is Mountford's grandson. Where are you, Terry? There, look. We found him in Queanbeyan. And him and his mates had this fabulous flag. I haven't kind of remember the details from the expedition, just in a garage in his brother's place. So you know how it goes on. Anyway, thank you very, very much, and please help yourself to the drinks, and I hope you enjoy the book.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.